O Lord our God, we come to this great study this morning of those whom thou didst use to reform the church. May we be even more aware, may we have a deeper appreciation of their work and of their dedication and of the heritage which they wrought for us. So, O Lord, wilt thou bless this meeting of this class. In Jesus' name we do pray. Amen. Last time I had been lecturing to you on what we might call the preparation for reformers, and I had centered upon Reuchlin in Germany, and I believe Jacques Lefebvre in France, or sometimes, I think he's calling your book Jacques d'Étampes, but it's one of the favorite statements that goes by all three names, depending upon which language you find his name written in. But most scholars call him Jacques Lefebvre, the great French scholar. And he was a great French scholar. We come now to one of the characters that I have a great deal of distrust, and I don't mean in knowing, but I mean in placing, in evaluating. And we come to Erasmus of Rotterdam, whom secular humanists have called the full flower of the Renaissance. He was born in Rotterdam in 1466. He died 70 years later in 1537. Unwittingly, I'm sure, he did much to advance the cause of Christ. Because in my candid opinion, gentlemen, I cannot place him as a Christian. That may be a harsh judgment. But he was a humanist. He did a great deal for the study of Latin, particularly Greek. And he edited the Greek New Testament. And we're indebted to him for these accomplishments. Because the Reformation in its linguistical foundation was built on the revival of Hebrew under men like Reuchlin and others, and the revival of Greek, and particularly not only the study of the Old Testament in Hebrew, but the study of the New Testament in Greek. I do want to make this point. There are those in our midst in the evangelical camp who disdain learning, and who say it's better to be ignorant than go to a university, lest you be tainted. Now, I grant you can be tainted. And yet, all the reformers, without exception, were born educationally in the bosom of the Roman Church. They all went, most of them, to Paris or some summer school. Now, if you're going to be tainted by Roman Catholic thoughts, Paris was there, the place to go to get a good dose. It was the home of Thomism. It was the home of the old theology. It was the home of everything which was opposed to the Reformation. And yet these men went to the various universities, some of the Germans down to Italy, Englishmen to Paris, Calvin to Paris, and they came through unscathed. And apparently fortified by their communication with unbelief. But Erasmus, in my opinion, was unbeliever. It has been rumored, perhaps I shouldn't even say this over tape, but it has been rumored he's a homosexual. We know that Leonardo da Vinci was. We know that in the Italian humanistic Renaissance, there was quite a bit of that. I say it's rumored because I have no way of proving it. But he was a cynic. Although he was a very Greek scholar. It was his attitude, it was perhaps his questioning attitude, which has made him the center of attraction to our humanists today. It was his questioning of Christian verities. It was his questioning he was the first real biblical critic, the first one to critically examine Scripture, not from what we call textual criticism, although he did do that, but to question the authenticity of some of the books in the canon. So, while he engaged in the lower criticism, which is the effort to improve the text, which is fine, he also engaged in higher criticism, which was to destroy the traditional and the biblical view of its own inerrancy and authority. So, I leave it with you. Well-educated, He taught Greek at Cambridge when Henry VIII gave him what we today would call a scholarship or fellowship to teach there. But when he died in 1536, his books were on the forbidden list by the Roman Church, and rightly so.
You said he died in 1536?
Yes. He was born in 1466 and died in 1536. His books were banned, and they were also frowned upon strongly by the Reformers. It's interesting, and not coincidental, as Erasmus lay dying, the presses of William Vite were, I should say, Stephen, were turning out the first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion by John Calvin. And that makes the year 1536 a very important year in the history of the Church. Those two events coincide because now Erasmus approved of Luther as long as Luther had attacked the papacy in his pocketbook. Erasmus was very bitter against the papacy and what he knew about the papacy. Well, I can understand it. I don't blame him for that. But he had nothing constructive to say. Only, I think I told you about his book, Julius Excluded, where Julius was excluded from heaven, Julius II, in the eye of the earth. Now, that was a brave thing to do. To openly write that a pope would be denied entrance to heaven was a hunting for trouble, to put it very mildly. He did it, but he began to denounce Luther after Luther's great works on the sovereignty of God and predestination in 1523. In which Luther came strongly out for the doctrine of predestination. And then, of course, Erasmus opened up his heavy guns on Luther. So that if I were given a course in the Renaissance as such, I would pay more attention to him. But I think you ought to know something about him. I think you ought to realize that he was an unbeliever. As far as I possibly can tell, he was an unbeliever. I want to see if there's anybody else I should discuss. I had to have an outline, otherwise I wouldn't know where I was. I believe that's all to do with that. I think I mentioned his praise of folly. Other things. I mentioned Jacques Lefebvre. It's interesting that these men should appear all at the same time, because Lefebvre was a staunch evangelical in terms of his own day. The Reformation had not yet come when he was appointed professor of Paris in 1512. He'd attracted the attention of Margaret of Navarre, who was the sister of Francis I. Well, I can hardly make claim that she was a modern evangelical or a branch of the Reformation. She was desperately in earnest about reforming the Church, and she supported Bishop Brissonnet, who was a Roman bishop who was engaged in reform in his own bishopric. And Brissonnet was very much interested in the work of Jacques Lefebvre, and he collected a group around him of like minds. As long as Margaret could persuade Francis to behave himself, this group flourished. But finally, it became so important that it attracted the University of Paris, and they lost favor, and Francis the First turned against it. and so the reform there had a short life. But Lefebvre lived on to become a fugitive with Calvin. In England, there was a group known as the Oxford Reformers, the most notable of whom, of course, were Grocer, Lineker, and so on, who, centering around Oxford University, became the center of an English evangelical movement. one of their members became dean at St. Paul, John Collett. Have you seen that in London?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's still quite a few people that sit around down. I mean, it's still sort of a very noted.
At Oxford, you mean?
Yeah. Well, no, the one area there is sort of a philosophy.
Yep. And there's what they call a college, there's Tyndale College at Cambridge, which is a center of evangelical influence. That's, as a matter of fact, that's where J.I. Packer was professor until he came to the country. But there are others there, along with Packer, who will soon review. So that the... Now, the question emerges, how do these men get their inspiration? For instance, the Oxford Reformers. If they just trace their lives, like John Collett, he was a great student, as were the other two. The problem is, what directed their studies toward the goal to which they were heading? Some scholars will disagree with me, so I want to be very fair about this. But in my opinion, they are the theological heirs of John Wycliffe and the Lollard movement. There are those scholars who believe that the Lollard movement totally died out. It was only 100 years before these men, and traditions like that didn't die out that easily. You take the Waldensians for a moment. They appeared at the end of the 13th century. the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century, in Italy and France. They still exist. There are Waldensians in northern Italy and southern France today. Mostly back in the valleys of what they call Piedmont Italy. And the southern parts. Have you been over there? You have, haven't you?
I've been through the area.
Well, do you know where the old Waldensians are in this country today? There's a town between Hickory and Morgan in North Carolina known as Valdese. V-A-L-D-E-S-E. That was settled in the 1890s by the Waldensians from Italy. And in honor of the old hometown, so to speak, they named the town in North Carolina Valdese. And there's a Waldensian Presbyterian church there. And they have you ever heard of the Waldensian bakeries? Maybe that's just us who have them.
Is that the Viennese type pastry, that real thin?
No. It's I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's distinctly Waldensian. There's a, if you ever go on Highway 70 between, well, let's say between Statesville or Hickory to Asheville, on the old 70, paralleling Interstate 40, they have a bakery on Main Street in Valdez, which has the most marvelous bread and cakes and all the northern Italian baked goods. People go from all over. They stop from Interstate 40 and come in buying material there. It's delicious. The Valdez is still at the point I'm making is this. I really have grave difficulties in believing that the Lollard movement, sponsored and spurred by John Wycliffe, died out that quickly. Now, there are many who agree with it. There's some who don't. After he was dead, the Roman Church dug up his bones and burned them to purge England of all infection, the infection of his heresy. I cannot see how burning one's bones would clear the air from it, only saturate the air with more.
That's
Wycliffe. Wycliffe. Yeah, they burned his bones. They paid great tribute to him, incidentally. That shows exactly what they thought about him.
But even when they burned his bones, you didn't go into the detail of how they did this. I mean, and when they made a very big ritual, they just didn't dig him up.
No, it was a high mass.
They celebrated.
It was a wild celebration.
It was a wild celebration.
They were purging the air of England from this terrible, terrible infection. Wycliffe. As if the infection lived in his bones. Well, again, the Oxford Reformers probably did not join the Reformation. John Collet became the great dean of Saint Paul's Church. Did you see that? When we were there, I was simply overwhelmed I was so overwhelmed, I didn't take my camera to take a picture.
What church was
this? St. Paul's in London. It's so massive. no, my camera, and most cameras would not even take it, get it in. What?
You couldn't possibly take that. They're still trying to, architects are still trying to figure out how to put those archways up in
the... I stood there, and our group was an architect from New York. I said, "Well, tell me something." He said, "How'd they ever get those arches up there?" He looked at me and says, "You tell me." I mean, some people have ventures that they did as they just did by piling mounds of dirt. they're what, 300 feet off the ground.
300 feet off the ground, each one self-supporting.
Yeah, and so to have that much dirt. to have a 300-foot mound, I think defies the imagination. I'm going to leave the question with you. I've never talked to an architect who could answer it. There's a good friend of mine in Salisbury, he's a noted architect, a member of the American Institute of Architectural People. We asked him once, he was showing films, and we asked him, and he said, "Well, there's several theories," but he plainly intimated he didn't believe any of them, except, of course, they had master craftsmen. But even then, it doesn't answer the question, how you can get them up there. See, they're supposed to have been backwards, and not technologically backwards. Now, undoubtedly, in regard to computers, yes. But in regard to fine art of building cathedrals, I beg the question. I don't think they were.
Yeah, they were in
the
Dark Ages.
Oh, yeah. But there's another question, too. How they ever make the stained glass windows a shard and Notre Dame? I have a friend who does stained glass work. I asked him. He said that died as the people did in the Middle Ages. Now,
Rushdoom, in one of his books, he talks about the difference in Christian education and the philosophy of modern Christian education is to publish.
That's right.
And back in the non-Christian education is secret. So, you know, they had a form for the stained glass windows, and the people were Christian. That was a secret.
It was a secret. It was not commonly known. It was a secret of the guild. Economically, the Middle Ages were divided into guilds. You had the guild of the gold people, the guild of the boot makers, the guild of the carpenters, the guild of the bakers. And people named Baker today are directly descended from the English guild of the bakers, or the carpenters from the carpenters. All these people were guilds.
Scriveners
from the right. Yeah. And so, and years ago, published a secret. Whatever guild to which guild you belong. And I said, I'm sure, I know it was a secret. And it's a secret not only safeguarded from any competitors, it's a secret safeguarded from modern man. Now, I mentioned the bread and the common life, did I not? Or did I? I thought I had. That semi-monastic order within the Roman Church. That was developed by Gruch and others, Gansport. Having its home originally in Netherlands, it spread up and down the length of the Rhine River into Germany, into Switzerland. And having this narrow base at its home, it spread out. I thought I told you they had Rudolf of Greek Law and Alexander Hegius as great teachers. now, again, the arch of this movement, Gansfort had been a very wealthy and dissolute young judgment. About like St. Francis of Assisi in his early 20s, he was dramatically converted. He gave up his wealth, he gave up his desires for the pleasures of the world, and he didn't become a recluse. What he did do was to found a semi-monastic group known as the Brethren of Common Life. But he devoted that group to education. And in my, it is not my opinion, this is a conviction, that this group educationally provided the background for the Reformation.
Luther, Calvin, and most of the other reformers had spent some time in one of the schools. What they did, they founded some schools of their own. But let's say they'd hear of a small town in the Netherlands or Germany, generally Switzerland, Netherlands or Germany. And the burghers, the shopkeepers, the chamber of commerce people, they didn't know too much about education, and they'd start a school, and then it would start to flounder. And the brethren would come and say, "Now listen, buddies, let's have a little meeting, we'll talk this out," and they'd say, "Now listen, your school's not doing well, let's just face it. I'm putting modern language in." And the burghers would look to each other and say, "Don't rub it in, we know that." All right, now the spokesman for the brethren said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll let you keep your school, but we'll run it. We'll take it over in managerial wise." They'd say, "Sure, go to it." Next, they start their own school. If they couldn't find one that needed their expertise, they start their own. And they from Deventer in the Netherlands down to Switzerland, and ultimately into France, and Britain to Germany, they developed a series of schools. In which they supply the leadership and the teacher. And that, we simply do not know what that did. Albert Heimer, a friend of mine, a great Christian historian, wrote a book called The Modern Devotion, sometimes called the Devotio Moderna, The Modern Devotion, in which he traces the history of the brethren. He became fascinated by them, and like me, he became convinced that previous historians had totally neglected the brethren, and they had. If you look in the 19th century Reformation writers, if you look into 19th century Renaissance writers, historians, oh, they might mention them, but they never really went to the record. Fortunately for us, when they did these schools, they would leave the minutes. They'd leave records of those who went to it. They'd leave records of faculty discussions. They'd leave records of the curriculum. So anybody who really wants to do it can really trace the history of the movement. It takes time. It takes work. But it's fascinating. I think I mentioned to you, though I'm not sure, that their most famous member was a man by the name of Thomas A. Kempis.
Do you have the invitation on
the story?
What? The author of The Imitation of Christ.
Right, the Devotio Christi, which has gone to, in the 15th century, we know that it went through at least 26 editions, printed editions after it was printed. It has never ceased to be available to the public.
What's the name of it?
The Devotion to Christ. It was really the first of a series of very fine works, for the most part. Morning Devotional. Have you ever read it?
No. I've got The Imitation of Christ.
I meant The Imitation. Imitatio Christi is what I meant to say. I was thinking of Devotio Moderna, which is the group to which he belongs. The Imitation of Christ has never ceased to be public. And evangelicals, Christians all over the world, love it. It breathes a devotion to Christ, and breathes a sense of being like Him, which comes from a godly soul, is all I can say. And the alleged Roman Catholic background is hard to discover, don't you think? But Christ appears in every page.
You said that they educated most of the leaders of the Reformation. Does that include Luther and Calvin?
Yes. Luther went to Magdeburg, and Calvin sat under one of the professors. This is my next step. One of the professors, Stolbeck, was a professor at Paris. Imagine. Remember the brethren. Now, of course, you must remember this. They, at this time, had not come into collision with the papacy. They were quote unquote, royal members of the church. They went to Mass. And then they breathed into evangelical doctrine. But they did it through the great process of education. Their schools became theirs. The school at Deventer in the Netherlands was a tremendously active place. The school at Magdeburg in Germany, it became a center of German culture. It also produced Luther and Bitter. You see, people, it's just today, there's some very good Roman Catholic schools where evangelicals are willing to go. The Washington University of St. Louis, St. Louis University happens to be one of them, at least it has been. Are you familiar with that?
No, it's like, I was just thinking when you said that, you know, if you even think of like in the last couple of years how Notre Dame's lost its sort of standing in the curriculum.
Yeah.
Standards.
Yeah.
Of how it's split to work.
Basketball and football have become the main.
Yeah, well, I think I was talking to this when I was visiting you. Paul Harvey did a thing, narration at 12 o'clock one time. It's like how basketball, football has become modern man's religion now, like on TV.
Oh, this is true.
They've given a price taking this.
Notre Dame was at one time a great school. I should tell you this. When I was lecturing at the Christian Schools Forum in Houston, Bob Ingram brought in a very noted Roman Catholic lawyer from New York City to discuss church and state from the Roman Catholic point of view. But this man was a real evangelical. I asked him where he went to law school. He and I were riding back to the airport together. I wanted to have a good conversation. I said, "I suppose you went to forum." He said, "Sir, I told you that I'm a Christian." Which was a slap on the wrist. I said, "Well, then you must have gone to Notre Dame." He said, "Sir, I just got done telling you I'm a Christian." I said, "Well," by that time he had aroused my chair. I said, "Well, where did you go?" He said, "I went to a little evangelical Roman Catholic law school, which would keep me in the good grace of the church, but which wouldn't hurt my faith."
Dean Mannion was head of that law school out there.
He was my friend.
He was the great hero of a lot of conservatives.
Yeah.
Wasn't he a Christian?
Yes, he was. I didn't mind the party well.
Okay. All right. Well,
my lawyer friend had turned so violent against the Roman Church that he looked down upon Notre Dame and Fordham and all the other schools, except this. I don't remember the name of the school. It could have been a St. John's. I don't know.
Could have been St. John's.
Which is much less strident and more evangelical in its outlook. And he felt it was safe to go there. I'm not sure it was, but...
I think St. John's was sort of kind
of basis. Mm-hmm. Anyway, John.
You keep talking about the brethren. Now, who were these brethren exactly?
That's a good question. A lot of them, so far as the printed page of history is concerned, are not mentioned. They were a semi-monastic order. They strictly obeyed the laws, the rules of poverty and chastity and obedience. But they were not enclosed in a monastery. Now, some of them would have monastic homes, but they would go, let me give you an illustration. Let's take the school of the Deventer, which they actually did. They built a monastery in the sense that it was the home for them to live in, because the Deventer wasn't much of a place. And they lived there, and then they go out to teach every day. It was like having a headquarters where you retired for two. Now, we don't know all the rules. My friend Hyma, H-Y-M-A, could never find them. He could find the faculty members of the schools. He could find the names of students who attend their school. But, you know, like any alumni association, they'll publish a lost and vanished list. They won't be able to find them. Apparently, these people were deeply embedded in the faith. The best I can tell you is this: I think in Germany, there's no question that what they rallied around Martin Luther. I don't think there's any question. In France, they first rallied around Lefebvre and Calvin. and their descendants became the Huguenots. Mm-hmm. I think in Germany and in Switzerland, they first followed Zwingli until he was killed, and then they stormed the camp of Bullinger, Heinrich Bullinger, the great reformer. I am not saying for a moment that they all became part of the Reformation. I couldn't prove it. You couldn't disprove it. Many of them vanished after they joined these schools, went back and became good carpenters, good bakers, good shop people, good teachers in some other school, good members of the church, highly moral people. As a movement, it was swallowed up by the Reformation. It had done its work. And those people who, now, Hegius and Rudolf Agricola had died. They never lived to see it. But Standing lived to see it. Luther lived to see it.
These were the bread and life brethren.
The brethren of the common life.
Thank you.
And they were established about 1384 or 1390, somewhere, 1400. They survived down, no, say 1525, 1530. Nobody really knows because there was no formal organization when they said, now we are journeying Sine Dea at this point, nor did it just suddenly come to being by a great general assembly. The schools came to being as they were established, and they turned out young scholars, they turned out young Christians to go back into the civic life of the town in which they were located. It's very hard to answer this question. We know they had an impact. We know that Erasmus went to one of their schools and turned against them because of their evangelical doctrine. We know that. Now, this is one of the imponderables in the study of the Reformation. It's like, they're in some ways like the Lollards in England, the Fathers of Wycliffe. The only difference is that the Lollards did not have established schools. The unique characteristic of this group of reforming or pre-Reformation reformers is their tremendous interest and dedication to education. There's no question about that. In the course of the history of Bible, I paid great attention to the Reformation as the evangelistic movement and the great church revival. You all remember that. Well, now we're coming to see why the heart of it, the foundation of it, was the profound impact of education. And no, education within the bosom of the Roman Church, on the school level, the schools I've mentioned, on the university level, Paris, the headquarters of Thomas, Oxford, the British headquarters of post-Thomism, Cambridge, Basel, so on, Leipzig. And there you have it. It is my conviction that at the root of the Reformation are to be found in the great educational movement today, led by the great scholars, Conrad Celsius in Germany, Johannes Reuchlin in Germany, the Oxford reformers in England, Jacques Lefebvre and William Bude in France. I just sort of mentioning a few. If I could get the attention and the ear of the church at large, I would emphasize this again and again, that the way to really impact the people, have an impact, an evangelical impact, a gospel impact, is not to send out untrained men, but to send out men who know what they're doing, who are well trained, able to meet contemporary culture on its own terms, evaluate it, criticize it, and then put it back together again, the light of the Christian gospel.
The fundamentalists are starting schools everywhere. Do you think they are going, that they are impact on society is going to reflect it, say, 100 years from now?
No, I
don't. They don't think they will.
They think so.
They think so.
Yeah, they say they're training the leaders of the country.
I know.
They're going to lead the country in 15 years.
I know that. Now, I'm not saying they do not have some good schools. But you're talking about the moon as a whole.
That's right. You know, what's going to be the consequence of all these schools?
Let me put it to you this way.
if
we can use the Reformation as an example, and I think this is what we need to do, we need to make this course contemporary as well as historical. You cannot compare the most of the modern Christian day schools, or no, let me rephrase, many of them I know, with these schools. Now, for some you can. I don't mind saying this, we have a Christian school in Salisbury, the North Hills Christian Day School, which is a good school. It is an excellent school. As a matter of fact, it is so good that the local school board is very much upset, both the county and the city, because it has the best faculty, it has discipline. If you bring drugs on that campus, if you come drunk on the campus, if you come there to work, take your right in. Their students are winning merit scholarships. They're winning scholarships, the Moorhead Scholarship at the University of North Carolina. They're winning scholarships because their scores in the national tests are, on the average, a year and a half to 2 years ahead of the comparative public school in the Rowan County Salisbury for that same grade level. Now, parents know that. And the Salisbury Post publishes those facts. And you can't argue that. At the same time, the headmaster, whom I know very well, is an excellent man. He knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. Now, you take that school, you take the Westminster School at Coleridge Church, you take the Westminster School at Gadsden, which I know very well, you take schools like this, and these schools are going to make an impact. But we have other schools in our area who construe Christian education to be simply starting off with a morning prayer, which is good, and reading the scriptures, which is good, combating evolution, which is good. But when they've done that, they've done it.
Most of the Christian schools use one of a couple of curricula.
Yeah, I know that.
They're very good looking today.
I know it.
And there's a lot of use of the Bible in teaching.
Now, this curriculum is good, but the law schools don't use it.
Well, we've looked into several. We've got our kids in a lot of Christian.
I know you did, yeah.
Area, we've been to several.
Do you mind telling me which one you're in?
It's called Faith Outreach Academy.
Where is that? Do you mind telling me?
It's in Snellville.
Oh.
It's
not
Gwinnett County.
Uh-huh.
And we probably looked at and talked to people, and probably a dozen of them.
Uh-huh.
And all of them used one of these two curriculums.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. I don't think they're so prevalent in North Carolina. This school does not use them, but it has based its own curriculum, but they've had educators to do it so that the... And I'm not talking down those. I'm not talking down upon that particular plan that you're mentioning, not at all. But this plan is very similar. Now, why I say this? All this approach is good when the schools do this. But some schools, which I know, don't do what you're speaking about, because that requires very well trained faculty who absolutely know what they're doing. How to apply scripture in the various areas. When they do that, those young people, hopefully, will have a tremendous impact. But I don't. What happened was, the School of the Brethren of the Common Life really took in the first 2 years of college. That's the amazing thing. They, on a more evangelical approach, they took in
the Chrism and the effectiveness of the old cathedral schools. There was a time when the monastic schools, like the school at Beck, which trained Anselm and Lanfranc and others, and the cathedral schools like Notre Dame and Chartres in France, were very good schools. And when the boys graduated from there, they went right into the last 2 years of the say University of Paris, and then into theology or law or whatever they had chosen as a profession. Now, with that in view, and I hope I'm being clear, Mike, do you have any questions? I want you to question your question.
Well, on the schools, the Brethren schools, mm-hmm. they use, like, their schooling is the basis of their foundation, right?
They use what?
The basis of their first initial foundation mm-hmm. of their education, and then they went on to further the education, like you were just saying, like law or something. So they were actually taking this out into their everyday
in what you and I would call the fourth form of fourth grade, about the age of 10 or 9 in some cases, they started to study Latin and Greek. So by the time they got to Paris or to Oxford or Cambridge, whatever school it might be, they were ready for anything that could be thrown at them. They studied logic. They studied pure Aristotelian logic in the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th grades. They studied grammar, rhetoric, and logic. Now, rhetoric we think of as public speaking. For rhetoric from the days of Augustine and those men on was public speaking, but it was more than that. Rhetoric involved the whole content of what you use for speaking. In other words, a rhetorician, a master of rhetoric, would not only be able to speak well in public, preach a sermon or teach what he was going to do, but he would have in his command a whole body of knowledge. He'd know the languages and the grammar. He'd know what we today, you and I, would call liberal arts and rhetoric, and he would have a specific study in logic. Then he would study music, arithmetic, and so on. Now, when they studied arithmetic, they meant the old arithmetic, and they meant Euclidean geometry and all pertaining to it. They had rudimentary science, astronomy. To think they didn't pay attention to astronomy is wrong. That was the so-called quadrivium they taught. Now, this logic is not taught in any high school today in which I have any knowledge. Do you know a high school that teaches Greek?
Oh, we used to get Greek.
I didn't say you used to, I agree. Uh-huh. There was a time when your parochial schools taught Greek. You'd have a hard time finding a day.
Well, the parochial schools, I feel, they had almost, the government almost forced them to change over to the public school.
That is correct.
They were between a hard place and a rock.
That is hard place and a rock. And this is the unfortunate intrusion of the state in the church by means of dictating the curriculum, which is very dangerous,
mm-hmm.
extremely dangerous. Don't let that happen to your school.
Fighting it.
Pardon me?
They're fighting it.
I'm against having our schools accredited.
Oh, I agree with that.
Now, I'll tell you why. The minute you do, you have already yielded your high ground of a distinctive biblical curriculum and a distinctively biblical interpretation and approach to teaching that curriculum. To begin with, accreditation today is a means of leveling education to the lowest level. To be accredited there doesn't mean much. I used to work with the Southern Association in accrediting high schools, the history department. I went to one high school, and this is a true story, and I don't mind just keeping this on tape. It was near Salisbury. I went to the head of the history department, introduced myself, and the head had invited me to the classes, and I walked into the class, and American history, and they were teaching the westward expansion in the 19th century. And the teacher was down the floor with a Lionel electric train running allegedly from St. Louis, Missouri to Sacramento, California, teaching them the westward expansion. I He had the kids around the floor playing with electric trains. I thought to myself that the covered wagon and the Brenner Pass when they
Donner Pass when I got wiped out.
I had trouble between the electric train and the Pacific Railroad and expansion west. After it was all over, the head of the department was a lady, and I went to her afterwards to to find out what she had in mind, and she said yes. She said, I want you to get my principal to get me a round table around a square table. She had a great big square table. I said, now what's wrong with this table? It was an approximate size of these three tables brought together, maybe a little larger, but not much. It was in excellent condition. I said, tell me, what's wrong with it? If I'm going to make a recommendation to the principal, I have no what's wrong with it. She said, can't you see? No. She said, it's square. Well, I had seen that. I said, well, what's the matter with the square table? You know what she said? She said, it has to be a round table. Of course, we have round table discussions.
Oh, no.
She did. I went to another class, allegedly, in world history. They were in the Middle Ages. And I had all I could do to keep my mouth shut. The teacher made so many erroneous and I felt totally dangerous remarks about the medieval church. Not that I'm, you know, where I stand, I don't defend its errors, but neither do I defend it. I think it's attacked what I think is right. But he didn't know what he was talking about. He was misleading that student, and he had no biblical conduct. Even when he attacked the Roman Church, he did not do it from a what you say a biblical position, but rather because they had an Inquisition. Now I didn't like the bishop's Inquisition. I think it was misused. I know that, but the Church was desperately fighting against heresy. I don't mean what you like would call evangelical heresy. Really. Mm-hmm. They had the Albigensians, who were really wild and woolly, and they had many other really heretical groups that were threatening the heart of the church. Now, I don't necessarily agree with the death penalty, but certainly they should have been handled. I do uphold the death penalty for crime, don't misunderstand. So that I wrote my report. I was only one member of the committee. I wrote my report, and you know what happened? The chairman of that committee rewrote my report. Afterwards, they sent me copies of the reports that all turned in. I couldn't believe it. He rewrote my report to commend the faculty for what was doing in the realm of education. And I had so been happy with what I saw. I refused to sign it. He asked me why, but not true. He sent it anyway. I don't know if he signed it afterwards or not with my name. We did have this problem.
Well, I found this out just the other night in Genesis class, New Testament class, we were got into talking about Alexander the Great.
Oh, yes.
And one of the students in the class is from a very liberal backing, and I said, do you realize what a maniac that man was? And he had no idea from his education. You know, he just thought he was some
he was taught great Aristotle.
Hero. Yeah, he just thought he was some great hero. That I mean, this
he was
guy,
he was blood and floor.
Man, this guy wore a lion's head over his head. And he died of, you know, I guess it, I don't know that they think he might have died of syphilis.
Well, that's been the common explanation, but of course, again, you have no medical proof of it, which would satisfy my science.
But he died very young.
He died very young, and he was not killed in battle.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I have a question on the brethren.
Yes.
How widespread would their movement have been? How widespread would their schools have been? If you went into a town,
if you go into town in the Netherlands, that by that time that included Belgium, they would have been rolling up. If you'd started up at the mouth of the Rhine River, and going down the Rhine Valley, you would have found a great many schools, either started by the burghers, or sometimes by monastic order that couldn't handle them. but largely burger schools. He's found schools started by the Brethren. You'd have found them in many towns. We honestly do not know. But I used to hate to use the word saturate, but they had certainly theologically, educationally impregnated their Dutch people. Because known for ages became the synonym for Reformed theology and for persecution and for opposition to the Roman Church, as you well know. And if you go to Switzerland, you found the same thing. If you'd gone into France, you would not have found as many schools because of the strong arm of the French monarchy. But you would have found outstanding brethren leaders who, clinging to the mantle of church, had worked their way into the faculties of the University of Paris, and probably the Law School of Orléans, which was the best-known law school of its day in France. We do know that the Calvin had a warm reception there, and that's my understanding. But there's no roll call of schools. I just don't know, Bill. I'd love to tell you, but I don't know, and I'm going to be frank. We know that their influence was tremendous. Even those who didn't agree with them admired them. And parents who might not agree with them sent their kids there. We know that Martin Luther's mother and father were not members of the Brethren of Common Life. I mean, not in 1508, when Luther went to school at Magdeburg. But young Luther turns up at Magdeburg. And he was so fond of his mother and father, it's hard to imagine he went there against their will. It's much easier to believe that he went there with their blessing.
There's a book on the Brethren itself.
Yes. It's Albert Hahnemann, called in English The Modern Devotion, or Devotio Moderna.
Could you spell
his last name? H-Y-M-A. He also wrote another book called From Renaissance to Reformation, and he discusses that length in there. He does more with its external impact in that book than he did the other one. The first one is more of a study of its internal history and the way they ran their school. There's also a new book by C.E. Post, P-O-S-T, called The Modern Devotion. I forget it. Oh, it was published in the Netherlands. It's in English translation, and we have it in our library. Here.
It's called The Modern Devotion?
Yes, it is, by C.E. Post.
That's the same name for
Thomas, same name, yeah, the name's not copyright. It was written in the Netherlands. Yeah. I'd say 15, 20 years ago, somewhere there. Now, having given this introduction, and I hope I've made it clear to you, I admit my certain ignorance on questions you raised about the extent. We don't know. It was not a denomination. They didn't keep official figures. You can trace the, and the good many schools' records are intact, and you can trace the name. But that doesn't tell you, because we don't know where they went after. Some of them we don't. Now, let's go to the cause of the Reformation. I've given the background, but what were the causes? Let me introduce this by saying, in my studies, I've come to the conclusion that there were two sets of causes, working at the same time, working at times independently of each other, and yet coming to a head in the movement which they produced. I would really say probably three sets of causes. Sometimes I divide them three: the theological and the ecclesiastical. I put on the higher term the religious causes. And the religious causes have two subheadings: the ecclesiastical and the theological. The secular causes are the political, the economic,
the social and the intellectual, namely the Renaissance. They would be the sets of causes. And I shall, in my lecture, follow that outline as close as I can, with obvious many deviations as situations come up. How would you define it? I would say that the Reformation was a great theological upheaval within the Roman Church. A great theological upheaval within the Roman Church which brought about the restoration of pure doctrine and the purity of the church hitherto unknown in Western society. And bringing with it a reformation in the political, the economic, the social, and the intellectual life of Europe. Question?
No, sir.
I thought you had. Anyone else a question? It was complex. You cannot, in my opinion, put your finger on any one cause that was a sole factor. I don't think you can do that. I want to give you a definition, which is rather funny. Roman Catholic scholars defined it as a certain giddiness which overtook Western Europe at the end of the Middle Ages. For a long, long time, the Roman Catholic Church, using its best historians, like Sarpi, Cardinal Sarpi, and others, did their best to downplay it. But as it advanced over Europe, the church could no longer ignore it. And in 1545, Pope Paul III was forced to call the Council of Trent to combat it. And incidentally, to reform the worst abuses in the Roman Church to a point where it wouldn't cause the harm which they had caused before. Having said that, let's go on. Turgot, a great French historian, and many modern secular historians have defined it as a revolt against priestly authority. Now, it was that. But there had been any number of revolts against priestly authority. The Waldensians, the Lollards, Wycliffe, the Franciscans, and Bernard de Clairvaux. There had been any number of movements throughout the Middle Ages which were revolts against the priestly authority. The Friends of God, John Toller and Germany, they were all, to a greater or lesser degree, revolts against priestly authority. Now, ostensibly, the Brethren of Common Life were not a revolt against priestly authority. It was more an ignoring of the whole thing. I mean, go about your business and let the priest bother, worry if they want to worry, but let's just go on. But they didn't openly revolt. They just bypassed it. But that was a formidable bypass. Now, I'm not denying that they were revolting against priestly authority. But to say that it was solely that, as Turgot did, is not true. There have been too many previous revolts which had failed. Which brings me to the question, why did the Reformation in the 16th century fail? I mean, succeed. When John Huss, Jerome of Prague, John Toller, the Oxford Reformers, John Colet, Savonarola, why did it succeed where all these well-intentioned efforts fail? Now, let me, to a degree, answer this question by giving a very simple answer, which I shall
used as a backdrop for all I had to say. Divine sovereignty. God brought together not just one man, but in his sovereign power, he brought together a large company of German, Swiss, French, Dutch, English, Scotch, and even Polish people, and one or two Spaniards, who were each in his own way working toward a goal. He brought them through the educational ranks of the Roman Church. They couldn't, nobody could say that you're an ignoramus. Nobody could say that you haven't been a good Roman Catholic. They'd all been nurtured in the Church. They'd all been educated in the bosom of the Church. Almost all of them were ordained in the Roman Church as priests. They couldn't level those charges against them. God, in his own timing, in his own way, his own place, with his own men, for his own purposes, sovereignly produced a Reformation Church. Now you say that you can't prove that historically. In one sense, I can. But if you go through the causes, I think you'll say, amen. To have all these causes come together in a harmonious composition, in a harmonious whole, within a very few years, cannot be by chance, but must be only by divine intervention, by divine superposition, divine ordination. It has to be. Do you disagree with me? If so, state your case, or forever after, hold your peace. Now, what were the causes? Go to it. I said that there were religious causes. And I brought them down between the religious and the ecclesiastical, or the ecclesiastical doctrinal. The papacy was a religious cause. By 1520, the papacy was cordially hated by some and disdained and spit upon by others. The lives of the popes had brought the papacy to its lowest ebb in the history of the institution. It was widely known. The German slogan I told you before was, the nearer to Rome, the further from Christ. The further from Rome, the nearer to Christ. And Germany being furthest from Rome, by definition, was obviously nearer to Christ than Rome was. The lives of the popes, the fascists that claimed, the bureaucracy within the papacy, all spoke to the point that the papacy was in bad faith. Now there have been Barraclough, for instance, a more recent writer, has tried to defend the papacy. He wasn't a Roman Catholic. He said that like any administrative hierarchy, the papacy got too big to handle. Now there's truth in it. You know, I was also an economics major, and in all businesses, there's a point of no return when each additional unit reduces the efficiency of not only that union, but of all preceding units. A good illustration of that, in days going by, you may remember this, the New York Central Railroad and the Pennsylvania Railroad were merged at the suggestion of the Interstate Commerce Commission. What was it? 1955 or 1960. And what happened? That whole railroad went into bankruptcy. What? You know why?
They couldn't support Pennsylvania.
No,
it worked again.
It was administrative ineptness. Why have big companies debt? International Harvest almost went into bankruptcy. It may still do so. I don't know, but it at least has escaped the time being, as far as I know. What happened to it? It simply could not cope with the situation. It had gotten too big. You have big banks that do that. I'm very fearful of tremendous expansion of banking for this reason. Now, using that as an illustration, the papacy was run by mortal man, by human beings who are not only sinners, but they're subject to error. And even if the papacy did not have any dark stains on its record, even if it had been manned by men of good intention and goodwill, good men, it still had become too big to manipulate, according to Barraclough. Now, he's got a point. I don't think that's the whole point by any means, but it is a point. The temple claims the papacy were no longer accepted by the rising medieval, by the rising state. You see, when Innocent III put forth his strong claims, John the First was on the throne of England, and the people were glad to get rid of him. And they didn't like Philip Augustus very much in France. But France was becoming a strong power. And it's no longer the days of Philip Augustus or Louis III or Louis VI, I mean Louis VIII. It's now Francis I, who's nothing if not strong. It's Henry VIII, who was nothing if not strong. He didn't need papal influence. In fact, he didn't want them. And in 1519, a very noble man was elected Holy Roman Emperor, succeeding his grandfather. And the man was Charles V, the most illustrious, the most adorned, and probably the most able Holy Roman Emperor from that time on until the end of the Holy Roman Empire. He didn't need the papacy to intervene in German affairs. As a matter of fact, they didn't like it. As a matter of fact, they weren't going to have it. You see what happened? The nation states had gotten powerful. And whatever justification there might have been for papal intervention in England, let's say in 1107 or 1150, 1170, with that situation with Henry II, that was no longer necessary. Because now you have states that are quite capable of ruling themselves with strong men who intend to rule. You see, the papacy was now out of date, or the medieval papacy was out of date. It was no longer needed. It was like having the state of North Carolina, the state of Georgia, charter a stagecoach line between Atlanta and Augusta in the hope that somehow it could survive going down with Interstate
20.
Federal aid. Yeah, Interstate 20. I mean, you know, that'd be pretty pathetic.
You could call it a historic route.
You could. It would be, too. And all the historians could write in the stagecoach. But you see, the medieval papacy was no longer able to cope with the church in this day, let alone the international situation. It took much more able men than the papacy could produce, because most of the popes were no longer men of great ability. They were the puppets of the de' Medici family or some other family, generally the Medici's. And the Medici's didn't want a strong man, the papal firm. They wanted somebody they could handle. And generally they got them. Now, the papacy then was a problem, as we have seen. But by the year 1520, the papacy was also very, very expensive. Leo the X at one time sold all the papal jewels and all the furniture in the papal palace because he could no longer support his retinue. Yes, he had his mistresses, but he also had created a huge federal bureaucracy. Some 2,000 people living off the papal income, which in terms of money that day was costing about $2 million a year. That may not be much to you. But $2 million a day would be about probably $40-50 million a day, something like that. That's expensive, and so I shall show you how to tax to get the support. But the Leo the X was not as bad as some of his predecessors morally. His critics said he was entirely too lazy to be too bad. He was a lover of music. He played his violin, and instead of attending the papal business, he played his violin and went on public display. But there were also, in the second place, terrible abuses in the church. Any ruler sets the moral tone. We often speak of the Victorian period of England, and we regard it as a great period of moral strength in England because Victoria was what she was. And there's a great deal of truth in it. We speak of the days of Elizabeth, because she set the tone for Elizabethan England. Not as moral as Victoria, but nevertheless it was a day of greatness in many respects. We think of the days of Henry VIII and we don't think of moral standards so much. We think of debauchery. And the Pope set the standards for the church. And inevitably, there was corruption. It was popular. Now, note my phraseology. It was popularly believed that there was a great deal of corruption, widespread corruption. All the priesthood was corrupt. Now, this is not true. There was widespread corruption. But it is not true that all the monks were corrupt. It is not true all the priests were corrupt. But it is true that the lives of the popes set the standard. It is true that the priesthood had sunk anew, and the life of Rome was reflected in the life of the clergy. The whole spiritual life of the church suffered. Inevitably, the cardinals who lived around Rome suffered. Do you remember the speech which Shakespeare put in the mouth of Cardinal Wolsey in his play on Shakespeare? he has Cardinal Wolsey says, "Cardinal Wolsey lay dying and gazes up in the eyes of Henry VIII, and he utters this memorable phrase: If I had served my Lord half as well as I served thee, O my King, I would not be in my present strait." He had sold his soul to Henry VIII, and he was reaping the whirlwind. Many bishops, many archbishops engaged in secular affairs, like Wolsey. They became advisors to kings, to archbishops, to counts, to dukes. They entered into business, and they neglected their particular charges, the bishopric or the archbishopric, the case may be. Cardinals and archbishops, the bishops seeing the Pope ride up and down the streets of Rome with his mistresses all dressed up and riding behind, as they did the same thing. The mistresses were more numerous than the upper clergy. And what about the low down priest? Well, when they see the bishop doing what they do, they do it too. There are recorded instances. Now, this is not total, but there were many priests who could not say the Noter Pater Noster in any language. They could not read the Latin. Many priests lived on such a small income that they kept what we would call inns or motels next to them. But that wasn't very lucrative. Some of them kept gaming houses where they played games of chance. And attached to that were brothels. And there are many recorded instances where the priest of Paris would have a brothel next to his rector on a gaming chance, and he might engage in selling liquors, something like that. This is all true. So when the people in the local parish see a priest with his mistress and a brothel and a gaming house around his rectory, it's hard for people to maintain a high moral life. Now, when the great crying shame was the sale of offices and dispensation, Leo X was notorious. Leo X had an income of over, in modern money, $3 million a year by selling offices. He sold 2,000 ecclesiastic offices. Let's suppose the bishopric of Lincoln becomes empty. It all dies in England. There's a rush and scramble from priests and other bishops who want to have more than one bishopric, or an archbishop to have more bishopric. And Leo X will send word to the bishops of England that the bishopric of Lincoln is vacant. What do you bid? One man will bid £5,000, and Leo say, "Forget, tell that guy to go jump." Another man says, £10,000? That sounds interesting. Tell him to see if he can raise it there. He raised the £15,000. He says, "Sold." Now, he did that for about 2,000 offices a year. But how did he do it? All right, suppose the Bishop of Lincoln gets an office but does something that the Pope doesn't like. Speaks against the Pope. All right, you know what the Pope will do? He'll declare, within the year, he'll declare bishopric empty again. Ha! here's another chance you'll sell it again. And maybe this time the stake will be 25,000 pounds. He will remove, bishops all over the church would die. They become vacant. An archdeacon will die.
Oh.
The abbot of Beck will die.
Oh.
Isn't there some rumor too that he was helping a few of them along?
Oh, let's not be gross. I don't see how you can say that. Let's just put
this way. That one book, he's killing the Pope.
Yeah, well, let's say this. They died mysterious deaths. That leaves it in limbo.
He used to invite someone over to...
Alexander VI did, sure.
Yeah.
He made a practice of, I think I told you, inviting them for dinner and then feeding them poison. But one bishop, one cardinal was too smart. He changed dishes. And there's a vacancy in the papacy. Now, that's not rumor. That's authenticated historical fact. Now, when you have a man buying a clerical office, we have a better operation. I'm ready to. But let me put this one. When you have a man buying a clerical office, buying an office of bishop, do you think for a moment that it's interested in being a bishop? Or be a feudal landowner deriving a huge income from his bishopric?
Would there normally have been businesses associated with these offices? Like you were talking about the casinos.
And not legally. They were not legal.
So they really weren't fitting for like a business license.
Well, not. No, but the Bishop of Lincoln, let's say, would have attached to him many feudal holdings worked by vassals. And those vassals would owe him X number of pounds of income a year in services. And if you have a large holding, large income. Most of the bishops lived like princes of the realm. They attended court. They advised the king. They held political office. They engaged in business off-color illegally. Yes. It was not illegal to have vassals, of course. That was part of the feudal structure. But you see, it was now a money economy coming in, and the income was money income, and it was very lucrative, very enticing. Let's have a break. I didn't mean to go find this one.